Shir's Ilui Nishmas Ephraim Ben Rav Asher Anshel. We're about to begin a new malacha, so we're not doing such a bad pace. We're ready up to the third malacha, and we're giving Shir for a couple of weeks, so we're getting there. Don't worry, we'll get to Bishul, the whole story's going to be over. But at least the pace we're up to now, we're beginning the malacha of Kotzer. So the malacha of Kotzer means to harvest. Of course, the primary image of Kotzer is the person is harvesting his grain, or the person is plucking his fruit off his tree. So those are obvious violations min haTorah of Kotzer. But there comes a major question that we should have raised, just how much is the ground, how much is agriculture a major component of Malach of Kotzer? Do we say that the Malach of Kotzer, the very violation of harvesting, necessitates that something is being plucked out of the ground, something that must be Gidulei Karka? Or do we say, no, that maybe we can even envision the Malach of Kotzer taking place something that is not Gidulei Karka? How in the world would we be able to extend Kotzer out of the realm of Gidulei Karka? If you understand that the essence of Kotzer, as you might use the phrase in a little bit of a different context, it's called Okedava Megidulo. The real Malach of Kotzer is not so much taking something out of the ground, but rather is breaking off the source of nourishment, breaking off the sustenance from where the item is grown from. So maybe one can envision that there are things that grow in different places. Some things grow on the ground, some things grow as part of a human body, some things grow as part of an animal body. So maybe we can begin to understand that Malach of Kotzer is not so much agriculture oriented. Maybe just the very essence of Oikidav Mikdul is what the essence of the Malach is. So maybe no, maybe we're wrong. But maybe Kotzer must involve the ground, and unless you pluck something which is Gidulei Karka, which is growing in the ground, that would not be the violation of Kotzer. That's a fundamental question that the Rishonim already raised. The context of this Machlokes actually touches on another Malach, hopefully we'll get to and speak a lot about down the line. But that's a Malach a little bit further down the line. And that's the Malach of Disha. The Gemara tells us that one of the Lamites Malachas, the Mishnah says one of the Lamites Malachas is threshing. So threshing, we all know what threshing is, right? Of course, we've all seen threshing. So you have your grain that's surrounded with this something or other. I have no idea what I'm talking about. But if you look at the back of the raisin bran box, you'll get a better sense of what's going on. So you have this grain that's surrounded with something, and then you apply pressure on it. And hocus pocus, the pressure breaks apart the outer part of the grain. Now you're left with the kernel, you're left with what is you're going to eventually make into flour and ultimately bake into bread. So at that stage of applying pressure and breaking apart the grain, that is the Malacha D'Oraisa of Disha. The Gemara quotes in Machloikis HaTanoim, in the seventh week of Shabbos, whether the Malacha of Disha is limited to Gedulei Karka, or whether we can apply even out of the context of Gedulei Karka. So what was the case? What was the Shaila Maisa? So very irrelevant Shaila, according to probably half the people sitting here. That's the issue of preparing Tcheles. The Gemara raises the question, if you have a chilazon, you have this clearly not Gedulei Karka, chilazon's the source of the fish, or whatever it is, of Tcheles clearly doesn't grow on the ground. We're not exactly sure what it is, but whatever it is, it doesn't grow on the ground. The Gemara quotes Machal Yisrael Tadam, what would it then be if a person squeezes the chilazon on Shabbos to extract the juice, to extract the blood of the chilazon in order to make his tcheles for tzitzis? Would that act of squeezing the chilazon constitute a malacha d'oraisa of disha? The Gemara quotes Machal Yisrael Tadam, whether yesh disha shelo b'gedulei karka or not. So Rabbi Yehuda is machmir, that disha applies even to non-gedulei karka, and the Rabbanan disagree, that ain't disha el b'gedulei karka. What is the machlokes? What are they arguing about? So clearly the machlokes revolves the model of Mishkan. We know that all of the cheshavos is patterned after the Mishkan, but whenever we use the Mishkan as a halachic model, so we have to be very, very wary, just which part of that, which parts of that model are critical, and which parts of that model are tangential. If a person would come up with the following svar, he would say, well, since the entire Malach of Shabbos, the whole enterprise of Shabbos is derived from Mishkan, so therefore, you only chaya for Chil Shabbos if you're Mechal Shabbos in the desert. Because you have three words, the Mishkan was in the desert. You only chaya for Chil Shabbos if your first name happens to be Betzalel or Aliyah. So that would be pretty silly. We would throw somebody out of shir for that. Why is that? Obviously, those are irrelevant details. It is true that the Mishkan was made in the desert, and it is true that a Mishkan was constructed by a man by the name of Betzalel. What does that do with anything? That's not part of the model of Hilchot Shabbos. So at what point do we say that the details of the Mishkan are critical? At what point do we say they were just coincidental? So that is the source of the Machlokes HaTanoim. So this is the very Nekudas HaMachlokes in the Chacham and Rabbi Yehuda. So Rabbi Yehuda thought the fact that Disha, as was practiced in the Mishkan, happened to have been the Gedulei Karka. the dish that they were doing in the Mishkan involved when they would grow the different herbs and different plants to provide the dyes for the Mishkan, and then there were acts of dish that were involved in the process of getting those dyes ready. So it just happened just by quirk to be that was Gedulei Karka, but the fact that it is or is not Gedulei Karka is not all that relevant. And the Rabbanan said no, that part of the model is critical, and therefore ain disha el ba gedulei karka. So the Ramban in Masechet Shabbos suggests that the same way that there was machlokes Rav Yudin de Chachamim vis-a-vis the malacha of disha, we can carry that over to the malacha of kotzer as well. If a person is kotzer from non gedulei karka, we're not sure what that case is yet. We'll get to that as we go on. If a person harvests, so to speak, removes something which doesn't grow on the ground, should we label that as ktsira d'oraisa? So the Ramban suggests, well, it depends on the machlokes Rav Yudin de Chachamim. If you hold like Rabbi Huda that the malach of disha can apply in shalabu gedulei karka, then it's not that far off to say that kotzer can as well. If you hold like the Chachamim that ain kotzer, ain disha el gedulei karka, then hua dinami similarly ain kotzer el gedulei karka. That's what the Ramban suggested first. And then the Ramban takes it about face. Then the Ramban says, no, it's not so simple what I just said. The Ramban argues that maybe everybody agrees when it comes to the malach of kotzer, it has to be dafka gedulei karka. What's the svar l'chalek? What the Ramban said at the beginning is very logical. So l'chor, what the Ramban is driving at is as follows, that sometimes the requirement of gedulei karka is something which is derived from the model of Mishkan, and that's subject to a machlokes tanoim, but that is a correct model or not. But sometimes the requirement of gedulei karka doesn't come from Mishkan, but rather gets to the very heart and soul, the very core of the malach itself. But the definition of the word kotzer, if you look up in Wikipedia, what does it mean to be kotzer something? So kotzer means ain ktsira of gedulei karka. Forget about the Mishkan. Not just because technically in the days of the Mishkan, that's what they did, but that is what the essence word of kotzer is. It's interesting that the word kotzer, which in English is translated to mean harvest, has taken on new meanings in today's world as well. We speak about harvesting organs, we speak about harvesting other kinds of things. So the word harvest, even in English, has taken on, a little Thanksgiving in Yom to harvest, but even the word harvest itself is a little bit unclear what the precise terminology of that means, even in English. So Kavachor in Lashon HaKodesh, it's not clear whether the word kotzer has a very, very specific connotation of Jewish character or not. So in order those settles, the Ramban writes, he's not sure what the din should be. Should we insist that any tzira el gedulei karka according to everybody? Or should we say no, that maybe it should be subject to the machlokes tanoim? At the end of the day, it probably doesn't make much of a difference because both Rabbi Huda and the Ravonah doesn't really matter what Rabbi Huda holds because we probably paskin like the Ravonah anyway. So we paskin that ain disha el gedulei karka, how much more so do we paskin that ain kotz el gedulei karka? So with all the dust cells according to the Ramban, it sounds like that's what the din should be. That kotzer is an absolute requirement. If you have nine gedulei karka, there is nothing to discuss. Nevertheless, if one opens up the Rambam in Shabbos, one just fiddles through the pages and looking at the Rambam's description of the halacha of kotzer, the Rambam never makes mention of this. The Rambam never says that ein kotzer ela gedulei karka. The Rambam says ein disha ela gedulei karka, but the Rambam never makes a note to say that kotzer is limited only to things that grow on the ground, which led them in Chaschinuch to think that the Rambam probably disagrees. Yeah, the Rambam didn't say it, so then the Rambam probably didn't hold it. The Rambam is very, very exhaustive in what he writes. He tells you everything that everything he ever wanted to know. The Rambam writes in his introduction to Perish of Mishnah, the introduction to Mishnah Torah, but he's trying to describe what the goal of what he wrote in Sefer was. So in his introduction to Mishnah Torah, he writes that his goal is to take anything and everything you ever wanted to know about Perish of Mishnah that exists under the sun, and he's going to put it into print. So basically what the Rambam is saying is that if I'm not writing it, it doesn't exist. If this is Kol HaTorah Kula, that's it. I mean, he doesn't say it if it's a halasha, but that's pretty much what he said. But anything you have to know, he's going to tell you every Gemara and every Bavli, every Shabbat, whatever is relevant to Lamaisa, he's going to tell you. So the Rambam didn't just leave pieces of information out. If the Rambam didn't quote it, that means the Rambam didn't think it was correct. So the Rambam seems to say that the Malach of Kreitza can potentially be applicable even in the realm outside of Kedulei Karka. Do we have any rayas from Chazal, any Gemaras, any real cases? So far now we're talking very much in the Olamas al Yonim. What about Tachas Lamaisa? Give me some real cases that this may become important for. So there is a Rishalmi that the Rishalmi speaks about trapping fish. Rishalmi speaks about going fishing. So the Rishalmi says that if a person traps fish, and again, probably some people here know more about fishing than I do, but Rishalmi describes that if you get fish and you corner them off and you get them, to the net, you get them onto the side, you get them away from their source of nourishment. So the Rishalmi says, you're chayav mishum kotzer. Rishami says the same way that if you harvest grain, Yechayim Mishim Koytzer, same way if you pluck an apple, Yechayim Mishim Koytzer. So if you pull a fish out of its source of nourishment, you're Oikidav Mikidulo, so one would be Chayim Mishim Koytzer as well. It is clear that fish do not grow in the ground, and the Rishami still applied the principle of Koytzer to it. So it's clear that the Rishami is taking a stand on this matter. The question is, does that bode well or not bode so well for the Ramban? So the Rishami says explicitly that you can have kotzer on non-kedula karka. How can others disagree?
So in that example, does the Rishami also told you also chayim
shum tzad? Oh, so that gets very, very tricky. Right? So the question is, does the Rishami mean kotzer la'afuke tzad, or does the Rishami mean kotzer in addition to tzad? So that's also not 100% clear. And so the question is, should we follow this Rishami? What's a general take about statements in the Rishami? So we have tremendous covet for the Halig Abaroya, who lived in Eretz Yisrael. The word Talmud Rishami is a misnomer. It was not written in Yerushalayim. It was not written here in Yerushalayim. It was written up in the Galil in Tiberia. But it was called Talmud Rishami because Yerushalayim is still in our hearts. But the Talmud Rishami, we take obviously the greatest care when it says the Talmud Rishami. But when all said and done, if there is a machloikis between the Bavli and the Rishami, so we side with the Talmud Bavli. That's one of the klali apsak. That the riff in the very end of Masechet Erev in quotes in the tradition from the Gaonim, that whenever there's a machlokes, the Bavli and the Rishami, we always will side with the Bavli. So it's critical for us to know, does the Bavli accept this Rishami or not? Why do we always follow the Bavli? What is that Klal HaPsach based on? So the riff explains that it's based on the principle called Halacha Kibasarai, that when you have a machlokes between different generations, so we assume at a certain point in history that the later generations, even though they weren't as great as the earlier generations, but they had access to the words of the previous generation. So they knew what the earlier generations held about a certain matter, and even though they knew that the earlier generations held about something, and they still disagreed, so then we apply the rule, Ein l'chol shevet shebiyam echa. Then we apply the principle, you have to go to the gedolim in your generation. So if the later generations never heard of what the earlier ones said, so then that's not a fair judgment. But if they knew what the earlier opinions held, and they still disagreed, so then we can assume that the halacha follows the later ones. That's what the Gaonim have a tradition that say, that already the days of the later Amorim, so we follow the later opinions rather than the earlier opinions, because the later opinions had access to the earlier opinions. So that's what the Rif quotes at the very end of Erevin, that the Chachmei Bavel knew exactly what it said in the Talmud Yerushalmi. They had access to the Talmud Yerushalmi. There was a lot of traffic between Bavel and Eretz Yisrael in those years. So the Amorim put together the Talmud Bavli 200 years ago after the Talmud Yerushalmi was closed. They knew exactly what it said in the Yerushalmi, and they still disagreed with it. So if they disagree with it, we apply the rule of Chesed Kibasra. That's what the Rif's understanding of that principle is. Rabbi Chaim Wasserman has a fascinating halachic / historic different twist as to why this principle is true. Why is it that when you have machlokes, the Bavli and Yerushalmi, why do you follow what it says in the Bavli? So Rabbi Chanan explains, we spoke about this many times in different contexts, that Rabbi Chanan explains that the koach of the psak of the Talmud Bavli is based on the following. Why is it that everything it says in the Talmud Bavli is binding in the halacha? The Rambam already, in his introduction to Perashat Mishnayos, makes this observation that after the Talmud Bavli was closed around the year, give or take around the end of the 400s, so after the Talmud Bavli was already sealed and closed, so you have different opinions, sometimes in different communities that crop up, different issues come up. So certain Ashkenazi communities accepted not the Kitnias on Pesach, and others never accepted that. So Chachmei Sfarad accepted certain things, the Chachmei Ashkenaz didn't accept. So you have this free-for-all after the Talmud Bavli, that different communities have different practices. But nobody would ever say, says the Rambam, that, well, this particular, we live in Bergenfield, and we're not from Bavel, so we don't have to follow what it says, what the Rabbanim in Iraq said. So whatever they said in Bavel doesn't interest us, we're going to follow the Bergenfield Rabbanim, not the Babylonian Rabbanim. So the Rambam writes, that's a joke. He says, nobody ever does that. For the last 1,500 years, everybody knows what it says in the Gemara, that's the absolute final word, the Tesh B'Peh. So where does that come from? What kind of koch does that have? Why is it that what it says in the Gemara ultimately is binding? That's a very fundamental question in all of Yiddishkeit. Why is what it says in the Gemara ultimately binding on us? So Rabbi Chanan explains that it's based on the principle of, the Rambam already developed this, and the Rav developed this in a little bit of a different context, that the basic machaye, the basic koch, the basic force for Tesh B'Peh is the Chachmei Torah. It means the Kiddush Baruch Hu told us, Lobo Shemayimi, that the Torah is not to be determined in Shemayim anymore. We don't base Shilas based on Nevi'im, we don't answer Shilas based on Osas and Mosim. All of this halachic discussion and decisions are made based on the Koch of Bnei Adam. So whoever is a royal lekach, the paskin a shayla, keep all of them chadav ala mishpat, those are the psuchim pasha shoftim, v'indam adam adin ladimre, you have to go, come to Belisa, you have to go and find out what the Chachmei Torah say. So in theory, the psak should be based on the rov of Chachmei Torah. So any and every shayla that ever comes up, you should put it up to a vote, and all the Chachmei Torah should weigh in, and whatever the majority is, that's what's supposed to happen. It's a very, very clumsy system. Every time there's a shayla, we're not sure, is this a good kavach, not a good kavach, wait, we'll take a referendum, and everyone's going to send in their ballots and their vote. We'll never get anything done. So therefore the Torah set up for us a system that you have almost like a representation in the Chachmei Torah. You have the Beis Din HaGadol, the greatest Tamei Chacham in each and every generation, are supposed to be the voice of the Tzibur, supposed to be the voice of the Chachmei Torah in each and every generation. It's the Moshel Madav Adom Lahavdil. It's almost like a representative democracy. It means we don't really, really live in a perfect democracy. A perfect democracy means that every single person votes on every single issue. So every time there's any bill sitting in somewhere in the house, so we should stop. Everyone should stop their work. They should send you a quick email, quick text. Everybody should vote. Do I want this or not? So it doesn't work. A riot doesn't work. So every year they make believe that we're still run the government like that. So they put up these bills on the voting thing, and they ask you, do you agree to this legislation, do you agree to that legislation? And nobody ever understands what it means. And then they write it to you in English. First they write it in legal Russian, then they write it to you in regular English, and I read it, and I never understand anything. I always say that, yeah, I'm not the top smartest person in the whole country, but I went to college, I went to graduate school, Smicha from YU, Kollel, a couple of degrees here and there. I imagine I'm somewhere around 50% in the greater scheme of things in the entire United States of America, and I never have a clue what any of this means. I probably can't figure it out. This is off the record. I tend to vote no on them because usually yes means more because it's going to cost more money. But that's my general mahalach in the Achayim, because I vote no. But it doesn't. It's not coming from any great knowledge of the issue. It's just coming from, you know, Sheva Tasa Adin. But in theory, that's how the world should work. So everybody realizes you can't run a system like that. So Havdalah Favdalah, so most democracies in the world today have a representative democracy. That the voting, the people vote for who they want to speak for their behalf. And then it's based on the assumption that the voted officials are speaking on behalf of those who voted for them. I mean, that may or may not be true, but that's in theory what's supposed to happen. So Havdalah Favdalah, that's almost like what happens in the Torah as well. That in theory, the voice of Torah is supposed to be all the Chacham in each and every generation. You can't have it that way. So you have to fall back on the system of having representatives. Now, this is not election. Being on the Senate is not a democracy. You don't run around campaigning to become a member of the Sanhedrin. You're appointed by the previous Sanhedrin. But the idea is that they're supposed to be the representatives of the Chachmei HaTorah. So Rabbi Chanan explains that whenever you have a situation where the whole system breaks down, you don't have that system anymore. You don't have a base in Agodo. The Romans don't let us have a base in Agodo. We don't speak anymore. So what do? So you have to go back to the old system. So the original system is all the Chachmei HaTorah. That's going to be very, very clumsy. It's going to take a long time for that to happen. So you're right. It took a long time. It took the entire period of Chachmei HaGemara to put together a book, to put together a text. It took 60 years for Rabbi Ashi to put together a text that was representative of the Rov Chachmei HaTorah in that generation. When Ravina and Rav Ashi wrote the Gemara, they weren't two individuals writing. They were speaking on behalf of all the Chachmei Bavel, and at that time in history, Chachmei Bavel were the overwhelming majority of the Chacham in the entire world. You had a few people in Israel, people here, people there, but the Ruba of the Chacham at the time lived in Bavel. So in the Chachmei Gemara, after 60 years, finally put together the Gemara in the final touches and in the last edition of the Gemara, so basically that was represented, that was the voice of Kol Chachmei HaTorah speaking in that generation. We don't have that anymore. That's what the Rambam describes, that 500 years later, there are the Rov Chachmei HaTorah. You have Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael saying one thing, Chachamim in Spain saying something else, Chachamim in North Africa saying something else, Chachamim in Germany saying something else. So each and every community has to follow their Chachamim. That unanimous voice, we don't have anymore. So Chachamim suggests that perhaps that idea that the Rambam describes of the unanimous voice of the Chachamim, that was present at the time of the Chassimus Talmud Bavli, but that was not present at the time of the Chassimus Talmud Yerushalmi. Because the Yerushalmi was written in Eretz Yisrael, and the Maisa, most of the Chachamim didn't even live in Eretz Yisrael at the time. So even though the Yerushalmi was made by great, great, great Rabbanim, it was individual speaking, great individuals. Rabbi Yochanan, Rish Lakish, Rabbi Lakish, these are not a bunch of kids writing the Yerushalmi, but it was written by individual great Chachamim. Talmud Bavli was written by the Koach of the Chachmei HaTorah of that generation. That's a different Koach in Halacha. So therefore, Rabbi Chanan suggests when you have a Yochid arguing with the Beis Din HaGadol, it's not going to fly. So if the Talmud Rishalmi is expressing an opinion of great, great, great Chachamim, but the Talmud Bavli is expressing a different opinion, then by definition, we're going to have to follow the Talmud Bavli. So that's the reason why we always opt for the Bavli over the Rishalmi. So again, different Mahalchim. Why is this halakhic truth true? Why is it that we follow the Bavli of the Rishalmi? Either because they're the later ones, or because they're representative of the Rav HaChacham. But when all the dust settles back to the Shabbos, so The Yerushalmi does say that you chayif a kotzer even on non-gedula karka. And the question is there a Bava that disagrees? So this gets very, very tricky because we have to identify any statement in the Bavli to the contrary. So that's the question. There is no absolute black and white statement to the contrary. There are certain indications to the contrary. So the Ramban collects a whole series of different statements in the Talmud Bavli that he thinks disagree with this Yerushalmi. There are sugyas in Maseches Bechavros, just in case anyone's interested. So the rates on Reishis Koch are going significantly high because there's a big market for it these days, but Shem, hopefully, it's a Shem, a few weeks, have a pigeon of hen. So I think I have about 3 swarm left, so I don't know if we're going to set the printing in time, but it's also good because the Fiyom is around the corner, the Bechiris also, so we'll see what we can do about that. But in the end, in the middle of Masechus Bechiris, the Gemara has an entire sugya about gozes, about shearing wool. The reason why the Gemara has the sugya is because the Gemara Bechiris is talking about Losabas Bechotzenecha. If you have a firstborn animal, so there's an issur in that Torah to shear it, to pull off the wool. So the Gemara has a whole discussion about the malacha of gozes vis-a-vis Shabbos and vis-a-vis Yomtiv and vis-a-vis Bechiris, the whole complicated discussion about the malacha of gozes. So nowhere in that sugya does the Gemara ever say that shearing wool, pulling off wool on Shabbos or Yomtiv would be a violation of kotzer. The Gemara always speaks about shearing the animal. The malacha of gozes is a separate independent malacha, and the word kotzer doesn't appear anywhere in the 5 lines of the sugya. So the Ramban says, from the fact that Chazal don't speak about it, that indicates that it doesn't exist. If the Yerushalmi is right, you can have kotzer even on non-gedulei karka, so why don't we ever speak about shearing wool being part of the malach of kotzer? For that matter, a person gets a haircut, shaves, cuts his nails, we should hit your with the malach of kotzer, because you're okay, double me gedulo. Your hair is growing, and you're pulling your hair off. The wool is growing, and you're pulling the wool off. So how come nobody in 3 blinders and his becheres mentioned the magic word kotzer? So the Ramban says, I'll tell you why, because it doesn't exist, because ain't kotzer, ela begedulei karka.
Similar to how we established the other halachas, why can't we say that kotzer is harvesting for the sake of nourishment? Meaning, we said, like, when it comes to planting, right? We said planting seed for it to grow. So why can't we say that harvesting is removing it from its nourishment?
Well, that's exactly the question. The question is, so some Rishonim, the Rambam says, that's right, that as long as something is removed from its nourishment, it doesn't matter where the source of nourishment, you would be chayav.
But you would be chayav,
but the problem is the Gemara doesn't say it. The Gemara says that when I pluck, say I pluck my hair, like a person shaves, a person gets a haircut, so their hair is now being removed from the source of its nourishment. So the hair is now not going to grow anymore. So that's the question. You have to check with dermatologists to how alive that hair was in the first place. Not too much for me to check, but those who can check. So again, so the Ramban made a big fuss out of this Gemara. Ramban said, oh, you see from these Gemara's Mecharis that there's no mention whatsoever of Kotzer. You see that Kotzer doesn't exist. So Mechaschinik says, you don't see anything. You just see that Gozes exists. The old Kotzer exists. The Gemara doesn't have to list off all 25 Malachas that are Chayav. The Gemara is just giving you one example. So the Gemara is talking about Gozes, but it's understood that Kotzer is also in the list. So again, this is not a smoking gun riot. This is not a riot that there's absolutely no Kotzer. This is a Mashmos, the Gemara, that there's no Kotzer on things which are not Gedulei Karka. So at the end of the day, it's not 100% clear one way or the other. Any other Gemara, so the Gemara talks about another Shaila. The Gemara in the end of Kozai and Masechet Shabbos talks about a person is animals giving birth, and the person, for whatever reason, I don't know, the person not going too well, and they want to save the life of the animals. The Gemara talks about the farmer sticking his hand into the area where the baby's coming out, and actually killing the baby. Okay, dove me gedulo, the Gemara says. That if a person's hoshid yellow behema, fidil del uba shivimeyah, so it goes in, he basically causes he aborts this baby, but it's not literally, not yet a baby, not actually born yet. So the Gemara talks about that being a malacha, and the Gemara uses the phrase, it's oike dove me gedulo. So some Rishonim say, oike vault, oike dove me gedulo, that conjures up a whole image, that's kotzer. Animals don't grow in the ground. So since animals don't grow on the ground, and the Gemara is still talking about Gedulah, so that's a Raya Brura that the Malach of Kaitz applies even to non-Gedulah Karak. That's what some Rishonim say. So Ramban says, no, it's not a Raya either. He says, you know why it's not a Raya? Because Okedav and Gedulah there doesn't mean Kaitz here. It means something totally different. It means the Tils to Shoma. It means to kill a live creature. If a person kills something that's alive, that's for sure considered to be a malacha. That's malacha of shaychei. So you have the wrong malacha. So again, we have a strange phenomenon over here. Everyone agrees that all these actions are also. Everyone agrees you can't go fishing on Shabbos. And everyone agrees you can't abort the fetuses of animals on Shabbos. And everybody agrees you can't shear sheep on Shabbos. Everyone agrees you can't pluck an apple on Shabbos. The only problem is we're trying to identify exactly which malacha it is. And again, it's not 100% clear. There is another possible application of this idea of kotzer, particularly in terms of just how much gedula karka is involved. We spoke a little bit about this in some of the Zerayah Shurim, about the sugya of otzitz. There's a sugya of an otzitz nokov and otzitz in a nokov. A person has a flower pot, and something is growing inside the flower pot. So sometimes that's considered to be a potential malach of kotzer, and sometimes it's not a malach of kotzer. So I want to just share with you one particular case that the Gemara talks about. We're not going to have enough time to elaborate upon the whole case now, but the Rashi is more fascinating than the case itself. More fascinating than the Lamzas is Rashi's description of what exactly this thing is, and hopefully we'll pick up with it next week to get into the details of how to place the Kodesh. The Gemara in Masechta Shabbos, Adaf Pei Aleph of Beis, speaks about a parpisa. The Gemara says, "Amar Abaye, parpisa v'yosel yodam." Something was mentioned about this parpisa. So Abaye says, "Well, somebody mentioned parpisa, let's talk about parpisa." And the Gemara has a whole discussion about is there coats or not coats, and the Rishon Rabban on this parpisa. The question is, what is this parpisa? It's hard to have an intelligent discussion until we know what this word is. So listen to Rashi's description. It's fascinating on so many different levels. So Rashi says, "Ubechubas ha'ka'olim matzasi." Here, you know, parpisa is a very, very strange foreign Aramaic word. You have to have a chabad and Rashi. Rashi's sitting in France in the 1000s. He's trying to free Rashi. He doesn't have a dictionary in front of him. What in the world is this? Before you can learn the sugya, you have to learn the metzias. The Gemara says is in Sanhedrin that before Rav and Paskin, Charles and Mumin, you would go visit the farmers. You have to know what the animals look like. You can't discuss something without knowing. We do it all the time. You have to make sure that you know what you're talking about. So Rashi tells you, listen to what the parpisa is. He found in one of the chibas tega'inim. They would make these little baskets made out of like lulav branches. They'd make them into little baskets. They would fill them up with dirt, and fertilizer. So they're going to plant some stuff in it. He says about 2 weeks or 3 weeks or so before Rosh Hashanah. Everybody would make their own little basket. This was the Chiddush Elul project, arts and crafts. Everyone would make this little basket. Every child would get their own. This is, you see, right from here, that school already started 3 weeks before Rosh Hashanah, or camp. So it's the end of the total project. So they're making these little baskets. What did they do with these baskets 3 weeks before Rosh Hashanah? Vizorim l'sochan pul ha-mitzri o-kidneyus. They would plant some seeds or some beans or some kidneys, something into rice, something they would plant into the, I didn't mean anything with the kinwa thing. They would plant something into these little baskets, the kernel of parpisa, and this was what the parpisa was. And what did they do with this thing? Fitzamech would start to grow. It doesn't take all that long for these things to begin to grow. Well, the Erev Rosh Hashanah, listen what everyone did with these things in Erev Rosh Hashanah, tell me what you think this sounds a little bit familiar. Everybody would take their own basket. They would wave it around their head. Shiva pa'amim. 7 times in Erev Rosh Hashanah. And listen what they used to say. Sounds vaguely familiar. So instead of chickens waving around their heads, so they used to wave these baskets around all their heads. And the last 2 words are mamash fascinating. And then they would take this basket and they would throw it into the river. What did this just do? We just combined kaparas and tash, the whole rolled into one. Very, very strange. So they threw it into the river. The mashmalos was, everyone's heard me before, adamant to him about not throwing bread into the river on Rosh Hashanah, because that's a serious violation of Chol Yom Tov. But when did they do this? When is it Erev Rosh Hashanah? They would throw these baskets with the seeds Erev Rosh Hashanah into the river, and they took their makeshift to kaparas and turned it into a tashlich and Shalom Yisrael. That minhag that existed in Bavel 1500 years ago, I don't know, has anyone ever, besides this Rashi, has anyone ever heard of this? No one ever heard of it, no one ever seen it. That was a minhag Yisrael in those days. So again, we have a little bit of it. The minhag of kaparas is a minhag from the days of the Gaonim. It doesn't appear in the Gemara. The minhag of tashlich is something that doesn't appear in the Gemara. So there are different minhagim in Yisrael, different times in history, different ways of making these kinds of symbolic ways of either throwing away your Averis or throwing around your head, different things. So the different minhagim in Yisrael have developed different places. All to try to get the same idea. So the Rashi is fascinating. But the background, what does that do with Kotzer? Because the Gemara now talks about this parpisa. I guess if it's the Shabbos for Rosh Hashanah and the kid gets hungry and he wants to pluck out some of the grain out of the parpisa, what's the story? So is this going to be Kotzer or is not going to be Kotzer? So these are Otzitz Nokov Shabbos because these are flower pots. Yeah, little flower pots, little baskets made of leaves. So these have a halachic status of an Otzitz. So how is Kotzer going to play out in terms of Otzitz? That's your next week. We'll pick up with this sugya about how kotzer is going to affect how moving a flower pot. Some kind of things that we have some very, very real shadows that come up for us.
The last night of Hanukkah.